This week on the Barrag World Show, we talk Pixar, organising your design assets and being awesome in interviews. This week's show is sponsored by Proposify and Teacup Analytics. BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name's Paul BOAG. Joining me, as always, on this week's show is Marcus Lillington, but also joining us is Sam Barnes and Andy Clark. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Good day,
hello.
Mate.
For some reason, you got an extra... You were made extra special, Marcus.
That's because I am extra special.
I don't know what happened there. I got carried away.
I think I might be completely brain dead now. My birthday has finally finished.
Did you have a nice time?
Yeah, it was great. We had the actual party, you know, a dual 50th birthday party on Saturday evening, which was great fun. So it was my birthday weekend 2-3 weeks ago. Then it was Caroline's, and then we had a dual party. On Saturday. So I've kind of had enough. Basically, I don't want any more.
Got your
birthday.
Money's worth out of it then.
Certainly did.
You know what's the best thing?
Sorry, go on, Andy.
Yeah, me. You know what the best thing, Marcus? You can start getting Saga travel insurance, car insurance, even a cruise.
I can be a Saga lout.
I tell you, the Saga cruises are bloody amazing. I've been on one.
So you're not old enough. You're not allowed.
No. Well, my dad lectures on Saga cruises.
Oh, right.
That's his retirement plan. Him and my mum just spend their life going around the world for free on Saga cruises.
That's amazing.
I know, right?
It's a genius.
I know.
There are a lot of rich people out there who do they retire to cruises because it's cheaper than going to a home. And you basically live the life of Riley swanning around the world on a big ship. So, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I like the sound of that.
I would like to start going on cruises, and my plan would be to engage with and seduce possibly a octogenarian millionairess and then swindle her out of her fortune.
You shouldn't have said that on the show, because we have a lot of octogenarian billionaireses that listen to this show, and you've just blown your plan now.
Yeah, no, there must be loads of people out there. I'd wear a bow tie and be quite suave, and I would take them into my confidence so much so that they'd trust me with potentially with their investments and then, of course, their legacy.
You're in a Poirot novel, aren't you?
Yeah, what is this?
This sounds like the plot of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Did you ever see that?
Yes. No.
Yeah, I've seen that.
That was an awesome film.
It was very funny.
With Michael Caine and Steve Martin in. Very, very funny. So how are you getting on, Andy? You don't need a billionaireess. You're living the life of Riley now, aren't you?
Well, no, I'm living the life of Sheila right now. We have Sheilas down here. Oh, maybe you shouldn't say that anymore. Maybe that's a bit too kind of Crocodile Dundee. I don't know.
Also, it implies that you've had some kind of sex change. Are you not living the life of Bruce?
Ah, Bruce. Yes, Bruce and Sheila. No, it's very interesting, actually. We've been down here for about 10 days now. So we've...
Interesting. Started... That doesn't sound very good. It's all right.
No. Well, work's been interesting. I was just saying to Paul before we started the show, it's interesting for me, for somebody that's, you know, worked for myself for nigh on 20 years, that not only now do I have responsibilities and I have people that work with me, you know, actual people, not internet people, I have to show leadership qualities. Can you imagine that?
Well, no.
That's the answer. So it's very interesting. We can announce, of course, that I'm actually I've taken this role as head of design at Ansarada, which is a lovely company down in Sydney. And when I came down here to do some consulting October, November time, there was one designer who tended to work just mainly on marketing stuff. And now that I've got here, they've actually got like almost half a dozen designers.
Oh, crikey.
So things have changed a lot, and they've kind of got new products and stuff, which has been happening since I was last down here. So it's been a bit of a period of adjustment. And I've been trying to sort of find out where my place is and, you know, how I'm going to kind of manage things. So we've got a nice set of goals for the next 6 months in terms of, you know, what we want to do work-wise. And that's been really interesting. And the place is great. I mean, I've never worked for a company before like this. You know, they have catered breakfasts on a Friday. And they have gym sessions twice a week in the office.
That's terrible.
With personal trainers. And then beer Friday, you'd like this bit, beer Fridays, 4 o'clock.
That's better.
From 4 o'clock on a Friday is like, you know, beer Friday. So
I want to go back. No, hang on a minute. I want to go back to the gym thing. Is this compulsory?
No.
Is it some Japanese kind of, you know, thing where they have a gym.
10 a.m.
They have a gym in the building, and you can sign up for these sort of, I don't know, I suppose you'd call them like HIIT training classes or something twice a week.
So, I mean, I could cope with yoga or meditation or lying down.
No. Friday mornings is yoga if you want to do that as well.
I could possibly manage that. Although I have to say, yoga's blummy knackering.
No, it's really hard. Yeah.
I couldn't do yoga. I'm not bendy enough.
No.
You have to put your body in weird positions and shapes and things, don't you? I just fall over.
Yeah.
That's true. I just tend to fall over anyway.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever I'm doing, I just fall over.
Yeah, so that's been work. That's been work. And we've found ourselves a fabulous little house in this area called Surrey Hills, which I'm really, really pleased about because it's literally a 20-minute bus ride from the centre of Sydney and work. And it's a really kind of hipster area. In fact, on a Saturday night come Sunday morning, it is so noisy, the sound of smashing avocados is deafening.
But how do you walk down the street? Don't you feel this need to punch everybody? Mm-hmm. I whenever I go to hipster areas, I was in a hipster restaurant a while back, I can't even remember where it was, and I just wanted to get up from my table and walk across to random people and just punch them in the face. It's something about kind of, and it's the conversations as well. You overhear snippets of conversation and it just makes me angry.
I haven't experienced the need to punch anybody in the face just yet.
You're not.
Give it time, Andy.
Give it time.
It's obviously just me. Perhaps Australian hipsters are nicer.
Well, it is a very laid-back kind of place. But there is plenty of moustache wax going on. But so you have to be careful of that in the heat, obviously, because, you know, it just drips.
So I must admit, I'm already sick of your tweets and Instagram pictures, and you've only been there 10 days.
I know. And do you know what? I haven't been as happy with work and stuff for bloody ages. So long may it continue. I mean, I was actually saying the other day that, you know, when I look back at the BBC News, which I try not to do, but, you know, I look at BBC News and, you know, no wonder I was bloody miserable. And I actually think that the weather and Brexit and all that kind of stuff was actually beginning to make me mad. So this is a real sanity saver. So I'm having a good time so far.
So in terms of the job, I mean, I get the impression of you've got a little bit of imposter syndrome suffering at the moment, or is it just wrapping your head around it more than you? How's that doing? Because you worked for yourself for a long time.
Yeah, nearly 20 years. Yeah, no, there is an awful lot of imposter syndrome. Certainly this week, I had a really slow start, Monday, Tuesday into Wednesday. I suppose I was a little bit tired or jet lagged, but I was like a deer in the headlights. And I was thinking, oh, my God, I've made this massive mistake.
Right.
And then on sort of Wednesday, maybe Thursday, I woke up and felt like my old self again.
Okay.
And this is interesting. I don't know whether other people have sort of felt this, but I've always been used to just being the guy that, you know, I work with myself on myself. So, you know, when somebody comes along, it's usually my opinion. I rarely have to kind of, you know, balance with other people. And yet there are really, really talented product designers there who, you know, I needed to kind of find my level with. And it took me a few days actually to realize that, hang on a minute, you know, this isn't a competition. That, you know, I'm here to do a particular job and they're already here doing a job that I can't do, don't want to do, wouldn't be any good at, which is the mechanics of product design. And, you know, that's not what my role is at all. And it just took me a few days to kind of feel confident in myself again, thinking, you know, no, no, you're here to do something different.
Sam, I'm interested because you've always worked in-house somewhere.
Yeah.
So do you ever imagine doing the other side of it, you know, doing a Brett and a Brett Honnard and going independent?
I've thought about it. I've done freelance bits here and there, bits sort of projects. It's usually consulting, though, going into companies and sort of really – it usually starts out as – excuse me. It usually starts out as something to do with their delivery process but turns into some sort of management consultancy because it tends to permeate all the layers. Yeah. But what I can say, Andy, is that the job I'm doing now is the first time I've had to work with other people at my level. So I haven't been the guy, but I've been the only person doing the job that the company's doing at that time. And after 15 years of doing that, and then now having to work with sort of two other engineering managers, I don't think it's anything to do with your freelancing or background because I felt the same pinch. It's just, I think it was like, there's something quite nice about it not being all on your shoulders, but there's also something quite strange about having people challenge your opinion in a way that I haven't had before. And there's this sort of human nature to sort of resist. But if I think about it for 2 seconds, it's like this is the first time I've had other input from people who understand everything that's going on. You know, you get external advice from people, but when there's actually people there suggesting things that don't necessarily make sense to you, I've had to learn in the last sort of 9 months to just listen. You know,
I want to treat this as a massive learning opportunity for me. You know, I think that for the last, well, at least the last 5 or 6 years, I've been pretty much treading water when it comes to not really expanding much of what I know. And the fact that next week, next Monday and Tuesday and half of Wednesday of next week is leadership training with like the senior management team. Now,
that'd be cool. Yeah.
I have no idea what that entails.
You probably find that you know more than you think, sort of learned it naturally.
But bloody hell am I looking forward to that kind of thing. And, you know, I've always just joked about meetings and emails and people spending all their time in Outlook. But actually, you know, I've decided, no, don't be cynical about this, you know, and think that you know best because, you know, just go for it with an open mind and see where it takes you. And, you know, that's my whole attitude to it.
Do you know what, Andy? That could make for a pretty good talk if you go through this for like a year and you can see what the journey from what you thought about that side of the business was compared to what you found. That could be quite interesting.
It would be. It would be a good talk subject. Mm. Going from a solo freelancer to a, you know, running a team.
But with preconceptions about what it was like versus what it turned out to be like and all the kind of, that'd be fascinating.
Mm. Yeah. You need to take notes as you go, Andy.
I ought to write a little diary is what I need to do. Yeah. Sue bought a little book today to write her stuff in. And I think I need to do the same.
Ooh. So, yes, that's good. Oh, I'm glad things are going well. I hope they continue. I mean, obviously, you're still in the honeymoon period. It must still feel a bit like a holiday at the moment.
Just to throw a wet blanket over it a bit, Paul, eh? It'll be miserable in a couple of months' time, Andy. You'll hate it. You'll wonder why on earth you went.
Oh, yes. You're always welcome to come down here. And, you know, it's not the best time of year to come, but we've got a spare room. That's not for the listeners, by the way. I don't want random Boag World people turning up.
Have you been bitten by anything yet?
No, but I have been given a spider chart so that I know my red backs from my funnel webs.
Have you seen any yet?
No, but I did see a cockroach in our backyard.
I bet they're probably cockroaches in Australia are poisonous, aren't they?
No,
they can
not
kill
poisonous.
You.
The size of a cat.
But they are. They're the size of a cat. I went to buy some bug spray in the local hardware shop, and in fact, they just gave me a hammer.
Yeah.
I like that.
With a gun.
Right. Anyway, we ought to move on. I just want to quickly mention season 18 of the podcast that's coming up, that we're going to do this thing where people can come on and they can give a little lightning talk. And what I thought would be really fun, because I haven't had anybody submit a talk yet, right? And well, I think a lot of it... What's that?
That's a bit odd.
I think, well, I think it's partly because June feels like a long way away at the moment. And then partly as well because I think a lot of people are honestly really nervous about doing this.
Definitely.
So what I was thinking is each week going forward, right, we could just, oh no, it won't last each week, but just for a little while, each of us could give one tip that helps them when they're preparing or giving a talk. So anybody want to kick us off?
I can do one.
Whiskey. There's Marcus's. Actually, do you know that isn't altogether stupid?
No, it's not. That's not something I don't like whiskey, but something to relax you or hype you up. I know the comedian, Billy Connolly, always drinks a double espresso before he goes on stage. Doesn't drink coffee or tea at all in the rest of his
right.
the rest of his life, but he basically takes drugs, I suppose. It's the equivalent of, isn't it? I'm going to have a big caffeine hit. So maybe hype yourself up or relax yourself.
I like that. Like, glass of wine before you record your little talk. Mm. Great idea. Oof. Make a huge difference. Sam?
Yes. I think, so this is something that I've always been told when we've had like a company blog or when we tried to get anyone to create content, I find that the most popular reason why people don't get started is because they think it has to be groundbreaking. They think it has to be some big idea, something that no one's heard of, something that will sound impressive to their peers or anybody listening or reading. And I repeatedly tell them that A, isn't the case, that they don't have to talk about something big and innovative. You know, just sort of going over the basics can sometimes be as reaffirming, and other people will learn from it. And that kind of leads into the biggest second point, is that people don't realise what they know that other people don't. So that what seems like common sense to them, because they've done it for years and years, or because they just have a natural aptitude for it, they don't understand that a lot of people don't have the same skills, I guess you could say. So I would just say, no matter how, sort of, if you think of a topic and you think, oh, that's been done, or I've got no new ideas on that, don't stop there. Actually write it, even as a draft. And maybe if you're nervous, show it around. Show it around some people and judge the reactions there. Quite frankly.
Also,
yeah, go on, sorry, Paul.
Well, I was going to say, kind of my follow-up point to that is that often it's not that you're saying anything new, like you say, but it's that you're saying it in a way that will appeal to people like you.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, that's what I often think, is the internet is such a big place and there are so many different kinds of people with different mental models, and you've got such a large reach that if you say something, it will be in a way that resonates with a certain group of people.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like the imposter syndrome thing. So I've read about this for many years now. And for most of those years, things that I read or watched kind of tended to have the same points. It was always good to watch it. I always found it fascinating. Mm. But only recently I watched another, I can't remember what it was. And there was the final part of the puzzle, which was that everyone knows about imposter syndrome and how you overperform. But it was the bit when you get praise for the work you've done whilst overperforming that actually makes the imposter syndrome worse, because you've now got.
Yeah.
And it was just this. It was just one little bit of an article that was the same as sort of most of the others, but it was worth reading for that point. You never know what kind of nuggets you've got that you don't realise.
Mm, absolutely, Andy. Do you have anything?
Yes. I mean, people prepare content for talks in lots of different ways. Some people start with a slide deck or some thumbnails of a slide deck on paper, and then they'll use that as their outline. I don't tend to do that. I tend to write my talks out pretty much as a script. If you choose to do that, quite often you can sit there looking at a blank screen or a blank piece of paper. And what you would sit and write, if you were to write that way, is not what would naturally kind of fall out of your mouth if you were speaking naturally. So what I like to do is to actually just get up and go for a walk, and with a little, you know, sketchbook or notebook or whatever and a pen, and go outside and talk to myself. And literally, you know, go for a walk, walk around, talk to yourself, sound a few ideas out, and you'll get a lot more down on paper than if you sit there staring at a screen trying to write a magnum opus, because, you know, it's just not going to happen.
Mm, absolutely. I think that's a good one. I often start with a story, even though often my talks don't end up starting with a story. The first thing I think about is, well, okay, you know, if I'm giving a talk, I don't know, on style guides, I just pluck that out of the air. because you talk about it a lot, Andy. But if I was giving a talk on style guide, I start by thinking of a time where I've used style guides, and I kind of write that out as to what happened and what I learned from it. And that's the kind of starting point for me. That often works well. Anyway, hopefully that's encouraged you a little bit to consider doing a talk for us. You can find out all the information about the logistics of doing that at boag.world/season18. Also, while I'm briefly talking about talks and that kind of stuff, we mentioned this very briefly. Well, actually, Sam did. He talked about an upcoming conference called Ground Control. And I'm running a workshop there on changing your organization to be more digitally friendly and actually kind of looking at the broader context of our job, but the organizations within which we work. I would, if you're available to come to London in April, check it out. I think it might be of interest. It's at boag.world/digital-workshop. All right, let's quickly do our first sponsor and then get into our second part of our discussion, because I think we've covered some good stuff, actually, in what is normally our pre-ramble. So our first sponsor is Teacup Analytics, which is an analytics package I use all the time. And also, I know the guys at Teacup pretty well, and I talk to them loads. I've learned so much about analytics through talking to these guys. Just take a kind of random example, like a question that clients ask all the time, which is my bounce rate good? I had such a good conversation with Teacup about this, the guys at Teacup, and about how they kind of approach it in their thinking and stuff like that. So the great thing about Teacup is that they directly answer those kinds of questions. So you can go into Teacup and you can find, is my bounce rate good? And you can add that to a report. But what I really love about them is the fact that that they've really looked into how best to answer these kinds of questions. So, for example, if you take that question, it looks at your historical data and your current visitors and current visitor behavior, and it shows your client whether the current visitors are engaging with the site better or worse than normal. In other words, it's not comparing you to some arbitrary value, it's comparing you to yourself. Because that's the problem with bounce rates, is that a bounce rate is very specific to your site, because, you know, like, for example, a blog typically has a very high bounce rate because people come in, read one article and then go away. And that's fine. You know, that's kind of established, you know, acceptable behavior. But on other sites, that would be a bad thing if you had a bounce rate, that kind of thing. So Teacup actually measure things in context of your own data rather than comparing yourself to some other kind of made up value. And that's why I love the guys at Teacup so much, is that they really know their stuff. And I've learned stack loads about analytics just from talking to them. So if you want to check out Teacup Analytics yourself, go to boag.world/Teacup. Okay. I think, Andy, as you've been away for a little bit, maybe you could kick us off today.
Yes.
Can I just jump in there? I didn't want to go first because I'm still writing mine.
I put you last because you said you were struggling to come up with something.
Yeah, I've got something now, but, you know.
Right. For people listening, putting together a talk, this is not how to do it. Just
yeah. You don't wait until you're actually on the stage and then
just
come up
make
with
it up as you go along.
Although I actually am quite in awe of that. That would be amazing to be able to do.
Have you ever? There are some people that do that, isn't there? Where it shows a slide and you have to talk about that.
Yes. What? Have you heard that? Karaoke.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. That just appeals to the way my mind works.
It's the closest to getting me to karaoke you're going to get, I can tell you that much.
Oh, yeah, you wouldn't get me doing real karaoke. Can't imagine it. Yeah, I was going to say, I bet Andy loves karaoke.
No, I do. I do country tunes. You should hear my Jolene.
Oh, I don't even want to know.
Anyway, should we talk about something else?
Yeah. Yes, go for it.
I want to paint a little picture, a little scenario for you. If you're a designer like me, even if you work, let's say you work on your own and you're working in, let's say, a modern design app like Sketch. I'm sure there's lots of people out there that use Sketch. if you're anything like me, your general working design process is going to be to create a file and to keep working on that file for a certain amount of time. And then probably what you'll do is, if you're working in Dropbox, you'll copy the file on a Tuesday and work on it. And then you'll copy the file and work on it on a Wednesday. And you'll be maybe adding a different, you know, file, a name, or, you know, you're adding the date into the file name. And then sometimes you might even be having the kind of, you know, the thing where the client wants to make changes partway through the day. So you end up with the date V2 or whatever. And what you'll end up with in Dropbox is a whole bunch of files where you've got a sort of a version control. You've got a certain history of the job, but it's not really version control in the same way that we might imagine it with code. Now, if you then work on a team, as I now do, you then magnify that process a lot, because not only are you potentially going to get conflicts if you're starting to work on the same file. So, you know, if one person opens the file to get something out of it while the other one's still got it open, you know, have you ever had that conflicted copy thing in Dropbox? Mm-hmm. Or you never really know which person has made changes to a file, or there's really no kind of version history. So some guys over in Silicon Valley, you've probably heard of them, Josh Brewer, who used to be at Twitter, and Tim Van Dam, he's now their design lead. Mm-hmm. They have started a new product, and it's called Abstract. And basically, think of it like GitHub, but for your design documents. So you can commit a file, a sketch file, to Abstract. You then make branches whenever you want to kind of, you know, make a branch and go off in a different direction. People can then clone your file and work on it, and you can merge changes. And all the things that you would do with a piece of code, you're now able to do with comments, of course, and issues and all the usual stuff with design files. And
sorry, you could you not do that anyway with GitHub? Or Git, sorry.
That's what I was going to ask. Is it just an easier way to interact with that system?
Yes, right. It is. Ah, okay. Yes, it is.
That's fair enough.
So they sent me a very – at the moment, Abstract is in private alpha. But they very kindly sent me an account a couple of weeks ago, which, of course, I couldn't really use for, you know, too successfully, because I was just working on my own. We've actually just started to trial it out at Ansarada, and so far, so good. It looks like it's going to be a really nice tool. There's obviously, you know, rough bits around the edges. But I would really strongly recommend that people go to abstractapp.com and sign up for the private alpha. They're doing a whole batch of kind of, you know, new accounts every week. But sign up for that, because I actually think that, particularly when it comes to collaborating and working in teams and stuff like that, this is going to be really, really, really good. And, you know, in combination with some of the stuff that Ryan's been talking about in the past, you know, the InVision stuff, I think that we've probably got the best set of tools for a design workflow that we've had for years.
I would agree. This is definitely something that's needed, because, I mean, we're terrible as designers, aren't we, at keeping our stuff organized. So absolutely, I think it's brilliant.
Abstractapp.com. Go and sign up.
Cool. All right. That's a really good one, actually. I'm looking through it now. I like the look of that a lot. Sam,
yes.
You're going to share some. Now, you talked about, let me get this the right way around. You talked about some tips for people interviewing other people.
Yeah.
And now you're going to talk about tips if you're a candidate.
Yeah. Yeah. So just sort of split it into kind of three sections here briefly. So the first one is kind of the approach to interviews, which I think is something I've learned over the years that's proved really useful to me and others. Then I've got a few questions that I think you can always consider asking. They're not the usual ones. They're kind of like to avoid disasters. And finally, some red flags to watch out for during that process. So when it comes to actually going for interviews, or when you're in the interview stage, I guess you could say, the biggest thing I think I can advise is how to view them internally. So I think, you know, for many years earlier in my career, and I think this is the same for many people, I found interviews to be a kind of a a sort of subservient process where I actually felt nervous. I would walk into these places and I would be desperate to please and impress. Mm. It was very much a one-sided conversation. Or certainly in my mind it was. It felt like I was the one there to impress, and sometimes the interviews actually back that up. But as I've gone through my career, I think that I've realised that was probably a mistake. And I think the earlier you can learn that it's actually a matching process with equal weighting on both sides of the conversation, the better for you. Yeah. So what I mean, the mistakes that people make, including myself, I guess, is sort of going into interviews and perhaps even doing well and taking a job because you're so just happy to be accepted rather than making damn sure it's a good move for you as it is for them. Obviously, they're offering. So, you know, things, just little things. So first of all, is to really get that mindset firmly in place that this is not just about you pleasing other people. This is about both of you finding a match. It should be, you should both feel the same at the end of an interview if it's gone well. So, you know, I think good rules for this is sort of don't assume you have to conform to the rules that are laid down about the process. So for instance, a lot of people will lay out what their hiring process is, what stages you'll go through. If you don't think that that's going to be enough for you, or if you, I mean, for me, for instance, I always ask to spend half a day on site if I can. Some people say no, that's fine, but some people say yes. And I kind of pick up more value from that than I do the interview sometimes, because you get to feel what it would be like to work there. You know, it's a lot less contrived. It feels more natural. You can hear other people talking, pick up the vibe. You can even speak to other people. You know, I mean, I think one of the things is if you ask to speak to other people that work there and that's declined, it's possible it's because of the process, but it's also could be a bit of an amber flag that they're a bit worried about what they people would say, right? So really, that's the main thing for the approach is that, you know, just understand it's a matching process. It's not for you to just impress them. They have to impress you too. Right. Mm. I think the other thing is, you know, this is a personal thing. Very few people take this advice, but I always say, don't lie to your boss. You know, take a holiday at the very least. You know, my mum gave me such a great advice before I even started working, I think, or maybe when I was first interviewing. She said to me that when she was interviewing, she would always ask the candidate, where does your company think you are today? And if she heard that they had said, oh, I'm at the dentist or the doctor's, and they were kind of smiling about it, it can be quite a good indicator to character. It's not foolproof, but, you know, my advice is when you're interviewing, take holidays. Don't lie to your boss, basically, because I think it's, I just think it's wrong. Call me old fashioned. So questions to ask kind of avoid disasters. I mean, I'm not going to go through the sort of typical ones. These are just ones I've asked in the past to kind of avoid bad moves. So I think you can ask things like, you know, what's the year-on-year turnover of staff in my department or the whole company? It's quite a good one. It doesn't always tell the story, but it can lead on to other questions. But it's interesting to ask. Plus, I think it makes you sometimes stand out against the other people interviewing because you're going outside of your specialised area. Mm-hmm. You can ask, why do most people leave? It's always interesting to get answers on that. You can read body language. Why did the last person doing the role that I'm applying for leave? Again, just interesting. And then very following on from the same position as what I, when I'm interviewing, I will always ask what are the best things about working here and also what are the worst things, and kind of like, completely, complimenting the other side of it. I think when someone struggles to answer what's bad about working there, it's quite telling, you know, there's always something about working somewhere. How honest will they be with you about it? I think that can be very, indicative of how a company may be towards you. And then, of course, what would the majority of the company say is the worst thing about working it? Again, these are really strange questions that I would never have dreamed of asking in my early days, but these are the ones that have avoided or helped me avoid some quite bad moves, I think, in the past. And then I think one of the biggest questions that I've learned over the years is, what are the company's plans? Is it for an exit, or is this a lifestyle business?
Yeah.
And I think the reason that I would ask this is just because I've spent a lot of my career at companies where I didn't even realize that was a question to think about or ask because I was inexperienced and younger, and that's fine. But what I realized looking back is that the amount of frustration I felt over certain things I've tried to get moving or tried to do, and I've got resistance to it and been knocked back, they weren't actually because necessarily the people thought the ideas were bad. It's because the strategy of the company was, you know, directly in contrary to what I was trying to do. So for instance, someone trying to do an exit in the next sort of 12 months isn't necessarily going to be focused on something that will pay off in 5 years, you know, but you don't know that. So if you walk into a business where you want to grow things massively, you want to change something radically or try something big, but you keep getting knocked back, it can sometimes be because it's a lifestyle business And people, mm-hmm. the owners of the business, and quite rightly, it's their prerogative to do this. They just want to take their salary and have a nice place to work and provide a nice place. But if you don't know that, you can actually become quite frustrated in an environment where you otherwise would be quite happy. And you know where to put your efforts, I guess you could say. Mm. So, and then finally, just some red flags really to watch out for when you're trying to get a job. And it's the big one for me is how smooth the whole hiring process goes. So you may have a company and a manager that you've spoken to and everything feels great, but sometimes the actual process of getting through the door and getting everything, all the interviews sorted or CV submitted, everything can be quite painful sometimes. And I just think this is quite a good indicator as to what that company may be like under the hood. So my experience, when a company has their, when it seems really smooth and slick and everything just seems on time, I think that's a sign of a company that at least is organized. Doesn't say much else, but at least it's organized. However, you know, if you don't experience that during that, it's worth probing. None of these are kind of like, don't take the job, but it's worth thinking about. Another really silly little thing that I've noticed, I'm not sure if anyone agree with this, but when I've been taking new jobs, I always like to take a break between jobs, just mentally reset and just kind of do stuff. Mm-hmm. When I'm told no, I've had that before. Now we can't have you taking 2 weeks. We need you to start straight away. I used to just cave in, and I think as I've got older, I think I'm coming to the conclusion that if a company can't do without someone in that role for just 2 weeks, it's worth probing what's going on. You know, sometimes it's a startup, small company, and there's reasons why it's completely valid. But if it's a bigger company, it can just be a manager's personal approach. It could be that they're just really under it with work. But again, it's strange when people can't, that, you know, they've probably gone through more time than that to hire you in terms of money and time. So yeah. it's just an amber flag that I always find strange when people won't do that. And penultimate thing is, when you're in that process, a lot of companies or recruiters will try and press you. You know, we have to know by today. We have to know by a certain date. Again, could be true, but just be aware that it might not be true. It can be a selling tactic or to try and get people in. And just my advice is, don't be rushed. You know, if you miss out on a job because you didn't commit quick enough for them, I think that's probably a dodge bullet, perhaps, because if you wanted it that badly, you probably would have committed, I think. So don't just feel rushed. Don't jump into a job. It's not a quick thing to get into. And then finally, is an obvious one. It's about being offered equity instead of salary, or salary rises promised after an arbitrary time. You know, things like that. Just be very wary of anything that doesn't sound quite right. And I would say get the money in your pocket rather than equity is my advice. And that's it, really. I mean, I could do, you know, we could do talks on half this stuff, but just some things I've noticed over the years that have helped me kind of just, if anything, they've helped me be more sure. They've helped me be more rigorous with my decisions, I guess you could say.
That's very rigorous.
Yes.
I just go with my gut, which is terrible, isn't it?
No, I don't think it is. I think overriding all of that is gut instinct. You kind of know whether you think you feel, if it feels right. But I think that the trouble is, when you're younger, well, certainly for myself, that desire or that emotion kind of suppressed, I guess you could say, boring logic. But that boring logic is where you're going to find out anything potentially that will ruin that emotion, you know? So I think it's obviously probably the differences between us as people as well, Paul, you know?
Also, the other thing I was just thinking, I can't remember the last time I went for a job interview.
Well, there is that as well.
Well, you know, here's another confession, is that at the grand age of 51, I have never got a job that I've applied for.
Have you not? Wow.
That's so far from the one you're in. No,
they asked. And that's been the way that my career has gone. People have sort of offered me an opportunity. But the only time, I suppose, that I did get a job that I applied for was when I was about 17 and I was pushing trolleys in Sainsbury's, and that was about it.
Crikey. I'm interested from the other side of things. Marcus, you do a lot of interviews. What do you look for?
I haven't done it. I haven't interviewed anyone for 18 months, but I have done quite a few over the years. I'll come back to that question because that's quite a tricky one. But there was one of the things that you said, Sam, that I thought, I think it's just to do with, because it was when you were talking about ask people why, you know, how many people leave from this department? Why do they leave? Why did the person that left this job? I think asking one of those questions is good, but I think if somebody kept pushing me on that, it would be, I would sort of sit back in my chair a bit and think, so what, why are they pushing me on this?
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. I should probably frame it that when I've been in interviews and been asking those questions, I'm always contextualizing it into the fact that, look, you know, I take moving jobs very seriously. When I move somewhere, I really want to commit and stay. Therefore, I want to be probably more sure than maybe exactly. someone else, you know. So if you didn't contextualize it, I think, yeah, it could sound perhaps negative. It could be someone looking, you know, I can get what you're saying. But as long as you're setting the entire interview up with I just want to be sure. I take this thing very seriously. I hope that kind of offsets the fear about it being negative.
Yeah. I think if you ask one of those questions, I think that would I would view that as a really good question that someone asked. If they asked all three, I'd
yeah, you're probably right, actually. Hang on. These are just notes. Yeah, you're probably right.
But to answer Paul's question, the thing I'm looking for most in any interviewee is enthusiasm by miles. I can think of interviews we've done over the years, and because we're not particularly tough interviewers, you know, I'm sure we've given we've said yes. When do you start in interviews over the years with some people? And it's usually because we've just got into this like enthusiastic debate about something, and you just realise that this is a great person that you really want them to be part of your team. I'm often brought into interviews, particularly with developers, who I can't really test their skill as developers at all, but just to kind of to see if any red flags come up from our side. Like, you know, are these the kind of people that we want to be part of our team? And it was very interesting that one about you said, you know, when you said the thing that your mum told you about, ask them, are they having, have they taken time off or are they sort of skiving off? And it's not the, it wasn't what you said about, oh, I'm going to the dentist. It's, and they smiled.
Yes.
That's the important thing.
That's the big, so I'm a big believer in, I've always told my boss when I'm going for interviews, but I realize I'm quite an oddball in that sense. But it's, so, you know, you can be sneaky in the interview if you want to be. It's entirely a choice. You can ask the question with a smile. And again, and it's leading.
Sam. That is what I think I've been brought in to kind of check out over the years. Yeah. Is this person a sneaky person that we don't want that kind of person working for this guy?
Well, I think it's depending on what company you're at. It's like you can get enthusiastic developers who are naturally disruptive in a good way, if that makes sense. They enjoy challenging, and actually what I've been brought into in the same fashion is to make sure that we're not bringing in someone who's actually a nice person, enthusiastic, good at what they do, but actually if we brought them into this environment, that would disappear. And there's probably become cynical or negative. You know, it's all coming back to the whole matching thing. Someone could be the best person in the world, but they still can be wrong for your environment or your team.
And that's why, you know, really at the end of the day, there is no point. I'm going to word this in a strong way. There's no point of trying to impress or trying to be something you're not in an interview, because the truth is that. You know, there is no kind of one thing that everybody aims for, or everybody wants from an applicant. It is so much about matching that really just go in and be yourself. Yeah. They'll either, you know, you'll either be the right fit or you won't.
Exactly.
But even if you pretend to be something else, you could equally pretend to be the wrong thing for that organization.
Very, very true indeed. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, because you think, they want someone who's very confident and enthusiastic. You know, because Marcus said on the podcast, you know, enthusiasm matters. And so you're not naturally someone who shows enthusiasm a lot, and you come across as a crazed maniac to the people that, you know.
That's very true. I think you can sometimes go, I mean, actually, I'd be curious what you think about this. So the whole dress code thing when you go for interviews, I've had it both, like, I've had it the full gamut, both as an interviewee and interviewing, where people would come in suit and tie, and the next person comes in jeans and flip-flops. Now, both of them are, you could argue, are being themselves. Do you think that it matters? Do you think you should extend, you know, or, you know, because a lot of people out there would say it doesn't matter where you're going, wear what you're comfortable in, that's it. But then I think when you're going to say, you know, a corporate, you know, do you do it then? How far do you take it? Or is it, it's a really interesting.
Dress is an interesting one because it's about respect to some degree.
Yes, it is.
So because of course we have this all the time going to, you know, meet with clients.
Yeah.
I always think you want to be, and this is really hard to judge, But in an ideal world, you want to be just a little bit smarter than everybody else in the room. Of course, you don't know how smart they're going to be before you go in. But I, you know, I always go, if you've got no clue, because, you know, for example, well, I go into higher education clients all the time, so I've got a good idea how they dress, and I always try and dress a little bit smarter than they are. But I think most of all, you know, if you don't know that, if you don't have an idea of how smart other people are, I always go by the rule of thumb of be as smart as I can be while still being comfortable.
Yeah, exactly that. Exact same here, Paul. That's what I've ended up on. I've tried both, and that's where I've ended up. And I would say you can, sometimes you can't tell what people are wearing, but if you do a bit of online stalking of the company, yeah, you can find some office pictures. And actually, I've done that before just to feel a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah. Andy, you were going to say something.
No, I was about to say that what you said is about respecting the establishments. We're about respecting the occasion, I should say.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would always want somebody to turn up looking like they'd paid attention, you know, that like they were taking care. You know, and you don't necessarily have to, you know, wear a 3-piece suit, but just make sure your shoes are clean.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, the same goes for things like language or all of those kinds of things. Yes, you want to be you, and you should absolutely be yourself, and you shouldn't pretend to be somebody you're not. But on the other hand, you've also got to respect the other people that you're being in the interview with. You know, I try and take the tone of, you know, I'm speaking to somebody. Yeah, you know, I'm speaking to my granddad. Right? That's the kind of tone. I mean, not in the kind of, this is how you turn on a computer tone of voice, but in that showing some kind of respect and being nice and that kind of thing. Yeah. It's a tricky one. It is a really tricky one. Interviews suck. That's why I avoid them. I'm unemployable. Right. Okay. I want to talk very quickly about my pick. Well, I say my pick, it's not my pick actually. It's Charles Roper from the Slack room introduced me to this book that I'm still partway through reading. I probably should have waited until the end, really, before sharing it. But I got so enthusiastic about it, I wanted to share it. And thank you so much, Charles, for sharing it with me. It's called Creativity Inc. by Ed Catmull, who actually, Andy, you so should read this book. Bearing in mind you're currently a design leader.
I have it.
This is, you have it, have you? Have you read it yet?
No.
What? No. It definitely, start reading it. It's really, really good. So it's by, Ed is the founder of Pixar. So it's this really interesting kind of autobiography, kind of, about his life and what he did and, you know, what went on in Pixar. But it more than that, really, it's not really that. It's really a book about creative leadership. Or in fact, even that is too narrow to say. It's just, he paints it as leadership for creative people. But I would say really it's a book about modern leadership. And how to manage, you know, knowledge workers, people who are hired for their expertise, and their thinking, and that kind of stuff. And it is an absolutely brilliant book. I highly recommend it. It's stuffed full of mistakes that they've made at Pixar, lessons that they've learned, things they did well, things they did badly. It's got a bit of Steve Jobs thrown in for good measure. It's just brilliant. Really, really good. So if you're in any kind of leadership position, if you manage teams, if you you know, are in senior management of a company, whatever, read this book. Highly recommend it. So yeah, that's all I wanted to say on that. Okay, Marcus.
Right. Yes, I was off last Thursday and Friday, and I hadn't thought of anything, and then the emails came through saying I'm speaking about this and I'm speaking about that. I thought, I haven't thought of anything. So, and I thought, have I, any books, any apps, anything like that? Nope, can't think of anything. And I thought, well, what are you quite good at? And I thought, I'm quite good at staying positive. So I thought I'd talk about staying positive. And it's actually, bearing in mind some of the emails that have come in this morning, it's quite apt.
Oh dear.
Yes. But there you go. That's just life and being busy and all those kind of things. And I, obviously this is more of a discussion than a tip. And it's something that we've probably talked about in the past, although I'm struggling to remember when.
But, no, I don't think we have.
But anyway, I'm pretty good at it. And I thought, well, maybe that can bring something to the table in a tip kind of fashion. And I'll kick it off and no doubt we'll throw it around the table a bit, and see what others think. But for me in life, staying positive has always been about having something to look forward to. And that could be work related or it could be, you know, out of work related. So, you know, I don't want to go to a party ever again at the moment, but you know, it might be that there's so and so's parties coming up on the weekend. So that's something nice to think about. But that's, I guess that probably the case of pretty much everyone. If you've got something that you're looking forward to, then that's going to likely keep you positive. So, but on a, maybe a slightly less, kind of obvious, tangent would be, and this is, you may disagree on this one, but don't get too hung up on targets or plans or deadlines. It's kind of like, Or allow yourself to miss targets, plans, or deadlines. And if you do that, then I think it's a lot easier to stay positive with the world or your life. It's almost like lying to yourself to a certain extent. I think if we overanalyze, then we can stagnate and get depressed about things. So if you're kind of always fleeting and keeping yourself busy and not worrying too much about, I must get this thing done now and then I can move on to that thing and then move on to that thing, because sometimes the things change, I suppose is what I'm trying to say. So if you allow yourself to kind of be a bit more fluid, then you're less likely to get, bogged down with things. And I think another way of putting that would be sort of trying to see the edges of everything you're doing at all times, i.e. be totally in control, can be actually cause you worry and stop you being positive. And the final thing I put down here is do random stuff. So if just break your days up, take everyone out for lunch would be something is one of my favorites because I like eating, which would be completely random. We've not any plans to do something like that, but we'll just write down tools. We're just going to go and have lunch or take a day off. If you're Paul, for example,
yeah,
go and fly your new toy.
Your drone. Yeah.
Or from a work point of view, work on, there's a good idea to have a kind of list of stuff that you'd like to work on, but you never really have time to. Is actually do one of those things, or at least start doing one of those things that you've been talking about doing for ages. Mm-hmm. So keeping things fluid and ensuring that you've got something else you can put your mind onto, I think is a really is the bottom line of what I'm saying here about staying positive.
And actually, you'd think I would disagree with you over that because I'm such a getting things done fan and, you know, I have lists for everything. But believe it or not, actually, GTD does back that up. You know, it discourages you from setting deadlines that are unnecessary, mm-hmm. right? Mm. You know, that aren't absolute deadlines. And it also, encourages you to be flexible as well, you know, to work on what you've got energy to do that particular day. Mm. I tell you, I'm at exactly that point right now. I've had a really bad stomach bug over the weekend. So I've been ill all weekend and I feel pretty crappy today. But the way, but I've got stuff, I've got to do some work, but I know I've got a big list of things that I can do and I could just pick the ones I feel I can most bear to do, if that makes sense, rather than getting into my head, I had to do this today. And, you know, so therefore I must stick with that. So I totally agree with that. I'll tell you another thing that's helped me a load is a quote from Mark Twain. Mark Twain said, I've had a lot of worries in my life, most of which have never happened.
Yes.
And for me, that is, I suffer a lot from anxiety because my brain runs ahead of itself, and I imagine scenarios. I sit and imagine arguments with people, right? So seriously, so you get a scenario like, let's say I bought something and have to return it, Okay. Mm. I will have an entire conversation in my head with the shop representative over, you know, exactly what I'm going to say. Oh, and they'll turn round and say it can't be returned because I've taken it out of the packaging. And then I'll say this. And you walk into the shop and they say, I want to return this. And they go, okay, then. And everything's fine. And, you know, so we spend so much of our lives worrying about stuff that never happens that I've taken to writing a list, right? Every time I worry about something that hasn't happened, I've got a list of that written down. So every time I start worrying about things, I just look at this list of things that never happened.
That's and
it lets me let go of it. Yeah, but I guess we should probably move things on, really. Okay, we're pretty much running out of time for this week. So, yes, thank you, Marcus. That was good. And let's move on to our sponsor. Our second sponsor is Proposify. So when it comes to writing proposals, let's be honest, time is money. We don't get paid to write proposals. Therefore, the longer we spend doing them, the more expensive it is to us as a business. And that's where something like Proposify comes in with its content libraries, because they can save stacks of time. So you can create these templates or these kind of little modules of content. So you could take the content and you can save it. So they're reusable stuff. So you can have, say, for example, save all your case studies, save all your fees, your bios, those kinds of things, reoccurring things that you're using time and time again in every proposal. And then you can just pop them into new proposals as you create them, which is great. You can also create templates if you want to, either create your own templates or use one of the predefined templates that actually comes with Proposify. So that means you're not starting from scratch every time. And everything, all your templates, all your content library stuff, it's all, you can tag all of it. So you can easily find the stuff that you're looking for. And it will all be versioned as well, which is really good. And they've got a whole chunk of functionality built around reusable fees. So if you've got products that you're always charging the same thing for, you can easily bring those in. And finally, they also allow you to save little short snippets of information to drop in, things like your address and email and all of those kinds of stuff. So all of these are kind of saved and reusable content. And then obviously there's your assets. There's things like images and videos and all of those kinds of things are saved for reuse as well. So I'll save you stack loads of time by using something like Proposify to create your proposals rather than doing it in InDesign or Pages or Word or whatever else. So to find out more about that, go to proposify.biz/BoagWorld. Okay, Marcus, do you have a joke to wrap us up with?
Yeah, a really brilliant one.
Oh, that's confident.
It's not. This is from Chris Forrance on the Bergworld / channel. What do you call a shoe made out of a banana?
What do you call a shoe made out of a banana?
A slipper.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's not bad. Not bad.
Bananas are slippery, apparently. It was Mythbusters tested it. I remember watching it with my son when he was much younger, and they tested the eternal hilarious falling over of people slipping on bananas, and apparently it doesn't work.
I think, doesn't it depend on how decomposed the banana is?
I don't know, but because, I'm sure I remember it saying it didn't work.
Because bananas get very slippy when they've really rotted
same
down.
Same as everything, though.
That's true. Yes. My corpse would be. Yes,
exactly.
Right. So let's wrap this show up. Thank you, everybody, for joining us on this week's show. It's been really good to have you guys here. Ryan will be joining us next week when he doesn't have an ill little baby.
And I won't be.
And you won't be. No, you're being replaced, aren't you?
Yeah, Rich Rutter will be on next week.
Rich Rutter, awesome. And just to remind people, don't forget to submit a lightning talk. We want your lightning talks. boag.world/season18. But for now, thank you for listening and goodbye.
run, run.